listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This July 20th would have marked 3 years since the United Nations Security Council unanimously approved what's become known as the JCPOA agreement with Iran, or the Agreement on Iran's Nuclear Program. On Tuesday, however, the Trump administration announced that the U.S. would be withdrawing from the agreement. This was President Trump on Tuesday.
My fellow Americans, today I want to update the world on our efforts to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. The Iranian regime is the leading state sponsor of terror. It exports dangerous missiles, fuels conflicts across the Middle East, and supports terrorist proxies and militias such as Hezbollah, Hamas, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. Over the years, Iran and its proxies have bombed American embassies and military installations, murdered hundreds of American service members, and kidnapped, imprisoned, and tortured American citizens. The Iranian regime has funded its long reign of chaos and terror by plundering the wealth of its own people. No action taken by the regime has been more dangerous than its pursuit of nuclear weapons and the means of delivering them. In 2015, the previous administration joined with other nations in a deal regarding Iran's nuclear program. This agreement was known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. In theory, the so-called Iran deal was supposed to protect the United States and our allies from the lunacy of an Iranian nuclear bomb, a weapon that will only endanger the survival of the Iranian regime. In fact, The deal allowed Iran to continue enriching uranium and, over time, reach the brink of a nuclear breakout. The deal lifted crippling economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for very weak limits on the regime's nuclear activity and no limits at all on its other malign behavior, including its sinister activities in Syria, Yemen, and other places all around the world. In other words, at the point when the United States had maximum leverage, this disastrous deal gave this regime, and it's a regime of great terror, many billions of dollars, some of it in actual cash. A great embarrassment to me as a citizen and to all citizens of the United States. A constructive deal could easily have been struck at the time, but it wasn't. At the heart of the Iran deal was a giant fiction that a murderous regime desired only a peaceful nuclear energy program. Today, we have definitive proof that this Iranian promise was a lie. Last week, Israel published intelligence documents, long concealed by Iran, conclusively showing the Iranian regime and its history of pursuing nuclear weapons. The fact is, this was a horrible, one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made. It didn't bring calm, it didn't bring peace, and it never will. In the years since the deal was reached, Iran's military budget has grown by almost 40%, while its economy is doing very badly. After the sanctions were lifted, the dictatorship used its new funds to build nuclear-capable missiles, support terrorism, and cause havoc throughout the Middle East and beyond. The agreement was so poorly negotiated that even if Iran fully complies, the regime can still be on the verge of a nuclear breakout in just a short period of time. The deal's sunset provisions are totally unacceptable. If I allowed this deal to stand, there would soon be a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Everyone would want their weapons ready by the time Iran had theirs. Making matters worse, the deal's inspection provisions lack adequate mechanisms to prevent, detect, and punish cheating, and don't even have the unqualified right to inspect many important locations, including military facilities. Not only does the deal fail to halt Iran's nuclear ambitions, but it also fails to address the regime's development of ballistic missiles that could deliver nuclear warheads. Finally, the deal does nothing to constrain Iran's destabilizing activities, including its support for terrorism. Since the agreement, Iran's bloody ambitions have grown only more brazen. In light of these glaring flaws, I announced last October that the Iran deal must either be renegotiated or terminated. 3 months later, on January 12th, I repeated these conditions. I made clear that if the deal could not be fixed, the United States would no longer be a party to the agreement. Over the past few months, we have engaged extensively with our allies and partners around the world, including France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. We have also consulted with our friends from across the Middle East. We are unified in our understanding of the threat and in our conviction that Iran must never acquire a nuclear weapon. After these consultations, it is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement. The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail. We will not allow American cities to be threatened with destruction, and we will not allow a regime that chants death to America to gain access to the most deadly weapons on Earth. Today's action sends a critical message. The United States no longer makes empty threats. When I make promises, I keep them. In fact, at this very moment, Secretary Pompeo is on his way to North Korea in preparation for my upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un. Plans are being made, relationships are building. Hopefully, a deal will happen. And with the help of China, South Korea, and Japan, a future of great prosperity and security can be achieved for everyone. As we exit the Iran deal, we will be working with our allies to find a real, comprehensive, and lasting solution to the Iranian nuclear threat. This will include efforts to eliminate the threat of Iran's ballistic missile program, to stop its terrorist activities worldwide, and to block its menacing activity across the Middle East. In the meantime, powerful sanctions will go into full effect. If the regime continues its nuclear aspirations, it will have bigger problems than it has ever had before. Finally, I want to deliver a message to the long-suffering people of Iran. The people of America stand with you. It has now been almost 40 years since this dictatorship seized power and took a proud nation hostage. Most of Iran's 80 million citizens have sadly never known an Iran that prospered in peace with its neighbors and commanded the admiration of the world. But the future of Iran belongs to its people. They are the rightful heirs to a rich culture and an ancient land, and they deserve a nation that does justice to their dreams, honor to their history, and glory to God. Iran's leaders will naturally say that they refuse to negotiate a new deal. They refuse, and that's fine. I'd probably say the same thing if I was in their position. But the fact is, they are going to want to make a new and lasting deal, one that benefits all of Iran and the Iranian people. When they do, I am ready, willing, and able. Great things can happen for Iran, and great things can happen for the peace and stability that we all want in the Middle East. There has been enough suffering, death, and destruction. Let it end now. Thank you. God bless you. Thank you.
That was President Donald Trump on Tuesday announcing the intentions of the United States to withdraw from the JCPOA, or the Iran Nuclear Agreement. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani was quick to respond.
Based on what we have been saying since 40 years ago, and we have been repeating this, and that is, Iran is a country that adheres to its commitments, and the U.S. is a country that has never adhered to its commitments. Our history in the past 40 years and even prior to that has told us and has indicated that the Americans, speaking of their approach towards the people of the region and the people of Iran, the Americans have always adopted a hostile approach. And that includes their coup against the legitimate government of Dr. Mossadegh, and also their interventions at the time of the previous regime and the support for Saddam, and also the targeting of an Iranian passenger plane, an Iranian passenger aircraft, and the killing of innocent people by the U.S. Warship, and also the measures they have carried out against the people of Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, and also the people of the Middle East region and the people of North Africa, and also the measures carried out by the Americans against the people of in other parts of the world. Tonight the Americans announced that they have pulled out and they have withdrawn from the JCPOA, and in fact it was an emphasis on what they have been doing in the past months. So since the signing of the nuclear deal till today, when has the United States ever adhered to its commitments? There's been a few statements being released. So has there been any action to the benefit of the Iranian people, or have the Americans acted in accordance with the nuclear deal and its framework? Based on what has been said by the IAEA, the Iranian nation has adhered to its commitments, and the Iranian government has actually fulfilled all its commitments envisaged by the JCPOA. But today, we are witnessing that a country that is, we can clearly see which country is not respecting the international commitments. JCPOA was not an agreement between Iran and the United States so that the U.S. would be able to just exit the deal. JCPOA has been a multilateral international agreement, and it has been endorsed by the UN Security Council and also Resolution 2231. Therefore, the United States officially announced tonight that it pays no attention to international commitments. Prior to JCPOA, Mr. Trump voiced his position concerning the issue of climate change, and he pulled out of the climate deal. And there were other agreements, such as trade agreements. He also pulled out from those trade agreements as well. So there's precedence to this, and there's a background in this connection. Our people, just a few minutes ago, witnessed that the only regime that supported Trump's standpoint was the illegitimate Zionist regime, the very regime that martyred our nuclear scientists, the very regime that is perpetrating atrocities and crimes against the people of the region and perpetrates crimes against the innocent people of Palestine. From this moment, JCPOA exists between Iran and five countries. In fact, from this moment, 5+1 has lost one of its members, and in such a condition, we should wait for the six major world countries to see what they are going to do in connection with this nuclear deal. I have ordered the foreign ministry to hold negotiations with European countries in the next few weeks, and also the other two major countries, namely Russia and China, to hold consultations and to do the necessary coordination and hold necessary negotiations. So if at the end of this short period of time, if we come to the conclusion that with the collaboration of five countries, it is feasible to attain what the Iranian people wish, despite the views of the U.S. and the Zionist regime, and also the impolite remarks by Trump. We should see whether it's possible to just keep up with JCPOA and also take steps in line with regional peace and tranquility. And if we come to the conclusion that our interests are not guaranteed, I will speak with the Iranian people, and also in such a condition, I will inform the people about the decisions that is going to be adopted by the establishment.
Those were some remarks by Iran's President Hassan Rouhani shortly after President Donald Trump announced that the U.S. would be withdrawing from the JCPOA agreement with Iran. The EU's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, also reacted to Trump's speech and made the following remarks on Tuesday.
More than 2 years ago, exactly in July 2015, the entire international community welcomed the result of 12 years of intense negotiations on the Iranian nuclear program. 104 pages full of technical details, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. It is not a bilateral agreement, it does not belong to any single country, and it is not up to any single country to terminate it. It is a multilateral agreement which was unanimously endorsed by the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. It is a robust deal that provides guarantees and a strong monitoring mechanism so that Iran's nuclear program is and will remain exclusively for civilian purposes only. We cannot afford, as international community, as Europe for sure, to dismantle a nuclear agreement that is working and delivering, especially now. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has verified 8 times that Iran is implementing all its nuclear-related commitments, following a comprehensive and strict monitoring system. There have been no violations of any of the commitments included in the agreement. The scope of the agreement relates to the nuclear program and is being fulfilled. The deal has prevented and continues to prevent, will continue to prevent, Iran from developing nuclear weapons. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action represents a key and functioning pillar of the international non-proliferation architecture that is even more important to preserve at a time of acute nuclear threat. We believe we have a collective responsibility to preserve it for our own collective security. The United States domestic process, and I underline domestic, following today's announcement of President Trump, is now in the hands of the United States Congress. The JCPOA is not a domestic issue, but a UN Security Council resolution. The international community and the European Union with it has clearly indicated that the deal is and will continue to be in place. The European Union continues to fully support the Iran nuclear deal and the full and strict implementation of all its provisions by all parties. The European Union, together with the rest of the international community, is committed to preserve it to the benefit of all, including the Iranian people.
Thank you very much. Have a couple of questions. Lawrence.
Thanks, Lawrence Norman of the Wall Street Journal. Can I start with the question of whether Mr. Trump can terminate the deal? You just said he cannot. He just said he can. Which one of you is right? Can you explain that to us? And secondly, and crucially, if Mr. Tillerson comes to you in January or February after a change in the US law, if that happens, and says, let's work on a successor separate agreement dealing with ballistic missiles and sunsets in the agreement, or Mr. Trump will kill this deal, what will you say to him?
I just spoke to Secretary Tillerson, and that was not part of our conversation. I don't need to explain to you that know the deal very well. This deal is not a bilateral agreement. This is not an international treaty. This is an annex, a very long annex, to a UN Security Council resolution, unanimously adopted. To my knowledge, there's not one single country in the world that can terminate a UN Security Council resolution that has been adopted, even more so adopted unanimously, and implemented, and verified, and with the rest of the international community continuing to support and implement it. So it is clearly not in the hands of any president of any country in the world to terminate an agreement of this sort, because this is a UN Security Council resolution. This is a plan of action that sets things to be done, commitments, nuclear-related commitments, and only nuclear-related commitments, and that is being implemented. So the President of the United States has many powers, not this one. The future, I believe, as I said, the rest of the international community and for sure the European Union will preserve the agreement. Can anything else be negotiated? I guess someone that has a deal-maker experience knows that to make a deal, you need to have an interlocutor that is interested and ready to negotiate to get to an agreement. And you should ask this question in Tehran right now. For the moment, this agreement is working, has been implemented, continues to be implemented, and not only as a high representative of the European Union, but also as the one that has the responsibility to continue to see the implementation of the agreement in place, I would expect all to continue to stick to it, as it has been now the case for almost 2 years.
Yes. Bonjour, Isabelle Horry, Europe 1, une question en français. Monsieur Trump a eu des mots très durs hein, contre l'Iran tout à l'heure en disant que c'était un...
Mr. Trump used very strong language in his speech.
Est-ce que vous pouvez expliquer aux Européens pourquoi c'est quand même bien d'avoir un accord avec ce pays-là?
Can you explain to Europeans why it's a good idea to have a deal with a country like this?
La dénonciation de, enfin la, comment on dit, la désertification de cet accord aujourd'hui.
And what do you think of this desertification?
Le discours du président Trump ouvre un processus interne.
Mr. Trump's speech opens a domestic political process.
Il ne se termine pas et l'impact duquel devrait être, comme je dis, évalué après.
The impact of this can only be evaluated later.
Décider ou ne pas décider si la position des États-Unis change.
If America's position changes,
l'accord n'est pas dans les mains des nations.
The deal is not in the hands of the United States.
Sur la qualification de l'Iran.
As far as the qualification of Iran is concerned,
parce que c'est exactement quand il y a un problème qu'il faut trouver un accord pour le gérer.
If there hadn't been a problem, we wouldn't have spent 12 years trying to resolve it. Long nights, weeks of discussions went into this. And it was an extremely detailed plan. The nuclear engagements taken by Iran were extremely precise. And we are confident that there was enough detail in this deal to make it stick. And our decisions since haven't been based on any trust, they've been based on observable verification.
Détails techniques et pas seulement techniques de l'accord si en profondeur.
The idea of reopening it or renegotiating parts of this deal implicates that the accord no longer exists. So there's no political space to actually do this.
Thank you very much. We will stop there.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. War in Remembrance. Today marks the 73rd anniversary of victory in Europe over fascism. This is one of the most important dates on the Russian calendar. That can't be said of the Europeans and Americans. We discuss how that conflict continues to impact Russia's view of the world to this day. Crosstalking the Great Patriotic War, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Xavier Moreau. He is the founder of the Center of Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. And we have Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University, as well as co-author with Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's talk about what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War, or as the rest of the Western world calls it, the Second World War. Now, Peter, you've been visiting Moscow. You've probably seen a lot of evidence celebrating the Victory Day on May 9th, but you don't see that in the West. You don't see that in the United States. Why the significant difference?
One big difference is that the Soviet Union lost 27 million people.
How many people in the West know that?
Actually, I've got some statistics on that.
Okay.
I did an unofficial, unscientific sampling of my students, undergraduates, not history majors, and I asked them how many Americans died in World War II. The median answer I got was 90,000, which means they were only 300,000 off.
Okay.
So that's not bad. That's in the ballpark. I asked them how many...
These are university students, too. Okay,
these are university students, mostly freshmen.
It's okay, Mark.
These are mostly
relax.
Freshmen.
I was a university student.
I used to teach university. Keep going.
And then I asked them, don't fall off your chairs yet. Then I asked them how many Soviets died in World War II. And the median answer I got was 100,000, which means that they were only 27 million off. So these kids know nothing, not only about World War II, they can't understand what's happening in Ukraine. They can't understand anything that's going on between the United States and Russia now. There is an extraordinary degree of ignorance in the United States about World War II.
Okay, is that intentional ignorance?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there is a deliberate role, both officially from the U.S. government, dominant within the U.S. media, and particularly perpetuated by Hollywood, of the role that the U.S. played. The YouGov put out a poll just this year asking the question to the U.S. and seven European states, in your opinion, which one country would you say contributed most to the defeat of Germany in World War II? Most Americans, surprised, believe that they played the biggest role by 55 to 11 percent. France. Most French, this is a big change from right after the war. Right after the war, 57% of French believed that the Soviet Union played the biggest role in the defeat of Nazi Germany. Today, 47%, the plurality, believe that the United States played the biggest role. Well, only 15. In Germany, a plurality believed the United States played the biggest role by 37 to 27%. In the UK, they believe that they played the biggest role by 50%.
Well, God bless their souls.
To 15%. Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and Norway, all also a plurality believe that the U.S. played the biggest role.
Okay, but that's a function of the Cold War. That's a function of NATO,
yes.
I would say.
It started just after the Second World War, actually, and especially for Germany, because if you remember, Manstein, who is a real Nazist, okay? He was not, as a legend, he created himself after the Second World War. He was not a loyal officer of Wehrmacht. Mm. He was a Nazist. He believed in Hitler and in the Nazi Germany. But he was advisor for the Bundeswehr, for the West Germany Army. Halder, the chief of staff of the German army in 1940, he was advisor for NATO.
It's one of those interesting things that you had good Nazi, Albert Speer, the good Nazi, okay?
Exactly.
And then you whitewash the rest of them, okay? You know, one of the most important things, the legacy of the Second World War, we have the division of Europe, we have the Cold War. But on the bright side, we had the establishment of the United Nations Charter. And I think that's really significant. Speed up to the present. I think, Mark, how many posture reports has Trump gotten? Three, I think, already. China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. They're the revisionist powers. I would posit, in light of the establishment of the United Nations Charter, and in light of what's going on in Syria, it's the Western powers, the revisionist powers, if you put it next to the United Nations Charter. We have the French, we have the British, and the Americans going all the way back to 1918, Sykes-Picot in deciding the fate of Syria in the Middle East, bypassing, and they say it's a legitimate bypass, of the United Nations Charter. Peter, that we're going backwards, and we're not learning some of the very few good things that we got from that conflict that ended in 1945.
Well, the first item on the agenda for the United Nations was nuclear disarmament.
To make sure there wasn't a third world war.
That's only been 72 years. We haven't gotten exactly close to that. I mean, the real purpose of the United Nations has never been achieved, and the potential for the United Nations has never been achieved. But during World War II, Roosevelt had initially a different approach. In 42, he asked Stalin to send Molotov and a trusted general to Washington in late May of 42. And that's when Roosevelt promised to open up the second front in Europe before the end of 1942. And it's also when Roosevelt said what we need after the war is four policemen. So the United States, Russia, Britain, and China should get together and we should maintain world peace, security, stability. And that was a vision that clearly was never put into effect. But we need leaders now who are going to act upon that kind of
vision. Well, we have a deficit of leaders, and we have institutions under attack, Mark.
It's worse because actually there is a will from the West to twist the idea of the international structures. And not only one, but every kind of structure. It could be anti-doping agency. It could be anything. They just want to make this structure, which were created, and I think it was a good thing just after the war, to avoid future wars. They want to use it as an instrument of the foreign policy. And that is very dangerous.
Well, what we have here is, and I've said this many, many times on this program, I really abhor the term used in the West, the international community. What does it mean? It means NATO membership, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Israel.
And Saudi sponsor.
Okay, that's Saudi sponsor. Again, this is a revision of the vision that was supposed to come about with the end of that most horrific war, which, given the statistics that you've given us, most Western publics have forgotten or have never been taught.
If you allow me, the speech of Macron on Le Drian, which is our foreign minister, just after the bomb Syria, was incredible. telling that it's you know it's they are not talking about legality because it's not legal. No. Absolutely not. But legitimacy.
Mm. Legitimacy versus legality.
And so how you can define it?
They will do it for you. That is a return to just war.
Yeah,
talk
exactly.
Of you know the late medieval period. In the West, in the halls of government, academia, and the media, which all echo, they continually talk about Russia and sometimes China as revisionist or revanchist powers against. There's two different world orders we're talking about. They refer to the liberal world order, not to the UN established world order. They're talking about the world order that they believe started with Bretton Woods and continued up through the collapse of the Soviet Union and came to its biggest height of unipolarity, of US-led Western hegemony during the 1990s. And what they're talking about is Russia and China returning to positions of great power status in the world are bucking their control of the world. Whereas Russia and China
and
others...
And they're not going to stand for it, okay?
From a realist perspective and, of course, from a relativist position of weakness still to the U.S., prefer the rules-bound system 1945 established by the U.N., whereas the U.S. regards the principle, UN principle, Security Council principles, UN Charter principles of sovereignty and non-interference to be antiquated policies.
Okay, I think you're paraphrasing Mr. John Bolton there. You know, Peter, one of the things, one of the biggest problems, and we'll talk about Russia's relationship with the West in the next part of the program, but I think one of the biggest problems is that you have policymakers and media in the West that can never put themselves in Russia's shoes.
Yeah.
To look at how they see the world. You know, NATO has demonstrated that it is it will pursue policies that are beyond the bounds of international law, meaning that it rises above it. And we got the legality versus legitimacy issue here. I mean, the Russians see NATO expansion as a threat. Okay, and there are, you know, here we are in 2018, and we have American and other NATO countries having their militaries on Russia's borders. I mean, this is the worst nightmare for the Russian leadership, considering today it's focusing on what happened in June 1941.
Yeah, well, Gorbachev got a promise in 1990 when he allowed the unification of Germany that NATO would not expand one thumb's width to the east. And then they started to hedge on that. And Hungary and Czechoslovakia.
Well, they lied. Let's just say, they lied.
What's interesting, I'm sorry.
But, you know, but then now NATO has expanded 13 countries to the east.
It's doubled its membership since the end of the Cold War.
But the real turning point came in 2008 when George Bush said we want to expand to Ukraine and Georgia.
Right.
And that was past Russia's red line. And and Putin has not allowed... or he can't really stop it, but he stood up to it. And what's happened since has made this a very, very dangerous world, beginning with Syria and the U.S. involvement in Syria and the Syrian civil war, and then what happened in Ukraine and the very conscious effort to wrest Ukraine from the Russian orbit, and what we've seen now with not only with NATO, but with the nuclear confrontation increasing. Putin's March 1st State of the Nation address announces 5 new nuclear weapons that can all avoid America's ballistic missile defense program.
But there was the olive branch of let's sit down and talk. We haven't heard a response from that.
Well,
I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Xavier, you want to finish up on this promise that was made to Gorbachev that the NATO alliance would not move further east beyond a united, it's very important, united Germany.
I think it was during the Oliver Stone interview. It was questioned about that with Oliver Stone. And Putin told that he made a report to Gorbachev that he should get a signature and not only an oral promise. And but and just after he told, even if it had been signed, they didn't respect it. But it just, you know, it's just a formal question, at least getting a signature. And of course, he didn't get it. And I'm sure exactly as all the agreements you can sign with the U.S. till now, it hasn't any...
Well, just ask the just Iranians, Minsk, yeah, okay?
Minsk agreement.
Yeah. Well, the U.S. Was not party of the Minsk agreements, but nonetheless here. Mark, you wanted to segue to more about NATO.
Yeah. I mean, as a U.S. military veteran of NATO operations, Peter brought up the number of the increase in the number of NATO countries since the end of the Cold War, 13, almost doubling the size of NATO. But that hasn't led to an increase in either NATO's military strength nor in its security for either itself or the world. To the contrary, it has led to greater insecurity for Europe. Montenegro, these other countries, they haven't contributed to the safety of the people in NATO countries. And there's a lot of challenges, that we need to expand to protect Europe from Russia, right? And they don't, that when Russia responds that they feel threatened by NATO's expansion, how could you be threatened by us? It's a fact that NATO and its member states are the most aggressive military bloc on Earth. The number of interventions, regime change, military operations in the past 20 years, or just over that, since the end of the Soviet Union, from Serbia to Iraq to Libya to Syria to Yemen today, how could Russia not feel threatened by NATO? They would be fools if they didn't see this blatant illegal military aggression as a threat to their state.
And NATO is a fig leaf to what's Washington-driven policies. The legitimization
issue. And the problem is it's gotten more and more dangerous. Yes. We're closer to a conflict. Four more divisions in Eastern Europe, NATO, plus additional American troops, more funding. Mm-hmm. And the Russians respond, of course. And they send troops to their side of the border. They got a nuclear-capable Iskander missiles in Kaliningrad.
Mm-hmm. And now we're developing hypersonic weapons. Mm-hmm. And where the U.S. is trying to make battlefield mini-nukes more usable. Right? We're leading to this is exponentially more dangerous. It reduces decision times. It makes strategic conflict much more problematic and difficult to stop and step
even
back.
Acceptable. That's what's really scary about it. Even acceptable.
I think we're in a worse position than we ever were in the Cold War.
But actually, the Russian was very clear. There is no new border on the nuclear war. As soon as you use nuclear bomb, you will get nuclear bomb.
If we are talking about
hypersonic weapons, new nuclear weapons, in my opinion, Putin did the same that Ronald Reagan did with the IDS in 1983. He started a new race. But this time, the trap is for the U.S. And it works, actually. If you look at on the U.S. Senate, I guess, I have already noted two strong declarations, like, look at what does Russia. We have to do the same, better.
Well, you have the anti-ballistic missile treaty that the U.S. walked away from, one of the pillars of arms control. And as we speak right now, we have decision time with Iran. Again, I was a very strong critic of Obama's foreign policy, but I applauded him for this amazing move because it's going against the trend of fighting nuclear proliferation, and it should be set as an example.
Okay. Right? Javier, I have to disagree with you. Putin didn't start any new arms race. The U.S., China, India, you misunderstand. The EU, Russia have all been developing
You misunderstand me. Yeah. What I think is that Putin exactly know how it works in U.S., that there is such a strong lobby for a military complex that if you just put some new card on the table, all the systems will start to work and to run without any control as it works now. Because if you look at the U.S. defense website, newspapers, any magazines, and they are talking about how we are going to get again the first place before Russia. They want to buy. Now there is again 1 billion to develop some...
Well, I mean, that's also a function of the military-industrial complex. Yeah, there's a lot of money to be made
This time it's Russia, it's Putin who creates the trap.
Yes, because they're doing it for defensive purposes.
In 1983, it was Reagan starting, we are going to build a new system of protection and so on.
No, that's right. Let the U.S. Bankrupt themselves with their
It's my opinion.
Peter.
Well, you were talking about things that Obama did well, the Iran treaty, but Obama also supported the $1 trillion modernization program over the next 30 years of America's nuclear arsenal, which we now estimate is going to probably cost $1.7 trillion.
He got a Nobel Peace Prize, right?
he did this after the Nobel Peace Prize.
President for a few months.
To be fair, the head of the Nobel Committee has since said, I made a mistake with that. No kidding.
But Henry Kissinger objected. So we're never going to give back our Nobel Peace
Prize. That's when the prize no longer had any meaning. Right. Okay, gentlemen, how do we get out of this downward spiral? Because it's good to ask this question today on the anniversary of the defeat of fascism in Europe, because the Soviet Union and the United States, along with France, along with Britain, were allies, and it was a world historic moment. Yeah. Now look where we stand. Peter, how do we get out of this hole, or we don't?
Well, we have no international leader on a global scale who represents anything beyond his own country's national interests. You were talking about the need to see the world through the eyes of our adversaries. And nobody's really doing that. Trump is incapable. Xi, I'm not sure what he's more narrowly focused. Certainly Merkel is not doing that. In all my interviews, I keep pushing Putin to play that role. But he hasn't done that yet. But we need somebody to speak for humanity.
That will be called aggressive behavior. I'm sorry. It's already baked in. Okay.
But between the U.S. and Russia, there are three conflict areas now. But we've got to find some way to sit down and talk and try to begin to resolve some, find something we can work together on.
The problem with that, and it's a discursive dilemma, because if you sit down and talk, that's appeasement, okay? That's how it's been painted by the current political establishment.
Trump accused Moon Jae-in of appeasement and when he wanted to talk to North Korea. And Moon told him to, go F himself, and made progress in terms of resolving it. This didn't get resolved because of Trump's threats.
Well,
it got resolved because of China and
South Korea. You could make the claim about Syria as well. When you look at the non-Western powers that are involved, I mean, we could put Turkey, Iran, and Russia working towards peace. That's something they don't recognize. Again, this is seen as a strategy of appeasement, and this is what I find most frustrating, because we had two major ceasefires in the works in Syria. What power upended it? It was the United States each time.
Yeah, since the establishment of the neoliberal global capitalist system, which has inevitably led to its own destruction by the trend of the West, anyway, of its originators, by the slow transfer of wealth from the West to the East, as the West declines in their relative share of global GDP and other countries rise to the fore. Until the U.S. and its client states in the West give up on the idea of the unipolar world, of U.S. hegemony, where they set the values and standards for the rest of the world, I'm afraid there won't be any peace.
But that unipolar moment is over. It's just there's not
no,
a recognition they,
it's not
of
a recognition.
But there is a recognition, because the one who announced it was Charles Krauthammer. And first he went from the unipolar moment, and then in 2003 he said it's the unipolar era and it's going to be unbounded. And then 2005, he says, well, the unipolar moment is over. Right. Well, so there is a growing recognition.
Even Fukuyama has given up on the end of history. But the U.S.
sold all those books, gentlemen.
The U.S. government, the U.S. political, and it must be said now, the European political elite have exceptionalist views that haven't given up on that. Until there is radical political change, which I believe is structurally impossible foreign policy-wise in the United States, then it is only the U.S.'s economic decline that will allow
room for the real birth of a multipolar world. I don't believe we need one global leader to lead the pack. I think we need recognition that there are multiple multipolar centers of power, and we need these world leaders recognizing their own limitations. Russia recognizes certainly now that it has limited geopolitical
horizons. But American exceptionalism does not allow for limitations. Xavier, finish
up. In my opinion, there is a reason for hope. It's that the Russia... yes, of course.
Mark?
let me be a bit optimistic. Because Russia is an open country. We are no more in the Cold War, when we have in the West such an image of the Soviet Union, that a great country where it's always winter, and that everybody lives under another street. So, for instance, in 1 month, and in my opinion, is that the reason why the West tried to get a boycott of this event. We will have, hundreds of thousands Western supporters.
To see that there aren't bears roaming around the streets, obviously you're talking about the World
and
Cup.
And it will be, and it's not, it's not intellectuals, it's not intelligentsia, U.S. intelligentsia, French, it's normal people, loving football.
Global citizens as football fans.
Yes. So they will come to Russia. They will talk to Russia. They will see that everything works not so bad in Russia, actually, that there is no aggressivity at all from the Russian population, even with the U.S. citizens.
All right, hold that thought here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.